Well, there are two subjects that often cause levels of concern. One is illness, and the other is sin. The book of Job deals with this matter in some detail, and we will not get into all of that, but we will touch on a few things. Our personal experience with both illness and sin kind of brings it close to home. Interestingly, we feel free to talk about our illnesses, but not so much our sins. And we are less interested in the illnesses of others than we are in their sins. One of our human foibles, I suspect. People often wonder if there is a correlation between illness and sin. And we may ask, am I ill because of some sin I committed? That was the accusation that Job's friends had of Job. Job, you're really messed up, so you must have really messed up bad. So what correlation is there between illness and sin? Well, we do know the theological answer, and that is that illness is a consequence of sin in general. So we know there is a relationship there because we live in a fallen world. It's part of what is part of that which is broken in our world. But is there a personal correlation? Does a particular sin cause a particular illness? And the answer to that is very simple. Yes and no. Depends what you're talking about. Because there are certain things that we can do that will cause problems. But then there are other things that happen that have no direct correlation. So that's the simple part of it. But the passage that we're dealing with today touches on this matter, and I will say touches on it. It's not the main focus of the passage, but because it's something that we often think about and encounter, we want to deal with it. And at least keep in mind that this is a matter of concern. It is a question that we sometimes have. I know of individuals in the past who have come down with some serious physical illness, and one of the things they inevitably ask is, what did I do to deserve this? And that's not uncommon. So, with that background in mind, let's take a look at the passage before us in John chapter 5, 1 through 15. And so there's a particular healing going to be taking place here. And so we want to think about the context of this event that includes a familiar tradition. And so we want to think about some of these details. And we read after this, and this has to do with the events that took place in chapter 4, which had to do with the Samaritan woman and the responses to her and what followed after that. So after this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now, there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. So that's the picture that we're being given, the context. We're kind of laying things out. And so we want to see there's something else that's going to be brought up in just a little bit, but this is a starting place. So we want to think about, we are now in chapter 5 of John. We've gone through chapters 1 through 4. Chapter 1 is really an introduction as a whole, and then chapters 2 through 4, we're dealing with the early ministry of Jesus, kind of preparatory. Now we're going to see a little bit of a shift. And so this new section begins with a second visit to Jerusalem. And there are several noteworthy changes in this section. So we want to think transitionally here for just a little bit. So in chapter 5, we see a change of standpoint or viewpoint, how things are being looked at. Chapters 1 through 4, the subject is described from the standpoint of the spectator. And this enables us to see something of the impression created on others by Jesus as he deals with individuals in Jerusalem and Samaria and Galilee. But in contrast, in chapters 5 through 10, we note a conscious change of that standpoint. We see Christ essentially expressing his own point of view, revealing the glory of his self-conscious personal revelation. So it's going to be kind of more from his perspective as opposed to the viewpoint of others that have been considered. So as a result, in each chapter, he is seen to concentrate attention on himself in various aspects because it's a self-revelation. And the people are enabled to see something of what he claims to be in relation to God and to man. So he's going to be revealing himself in different aspects. This section also begins a movement of conflict leading to the crucifixion. And we see that this opposition, conflict, is going to begin to grow. So up to this time, Jesus has offered himself to typical representatives of the whole Jewish race at Jerusalem, in Judea, in Samaria, and in Galilee. And he did so in such a way as to satisfy the elements of true faith, or to indicate something of what the expectation is for faith. And there's going to be this contrast between belief and unbelief. And, of course, that's the whole emphasis of the Gospel of John. But now the conflict begins, and it's going to result ultimately in the passion of Christ, in the week of crucifixion and all of that. That's going to be leading to. But step by step here, faith and unbelief are sort of called out in a parallel development. And the crisis of its development are the crises of its development are the national festivals, the events that would bring Jesus to Jerusalem. And the whole controversy is especially gathered around three miracles. The miracle of the impotent man at Bethesda, that's the passage we're talking about today. And then there's the healing of the man born blind, which is coming up, and then the raising of Lazarus in chapter 11. So the miracles in this section are also more public, and that's going to lead to greater opposition and conflict because more people are going to be aware of it, and those people that are skeptical are going to be present to see it, and they will respond or react as the case may be. So until now, John was presenting Jesus as dealing mainly with individuals. And that's going to continue, but there's going to be more reaction and interaction with the Pharisees, and that's because there's more public exposure and there's closer proximity to the religious center, which is Jerusalem. So the events that are particularly tied to Jerusalem, where the center of the religious folks were, and the political, for that matter, that's going to be sort of at issue. So the first two signs that John recorded were done privately, but the next two were public. Also, Jesus did the miracle recorded in chapter 5 on the Sabbath day. That is a no-no. And that drew the attention and the opposition of the Pharisees. And it caused reactions to Jesus among the Jews that moved from sort of reservation, like chapter 3, verses 1 through 15, to outright hostility, as we'll see. And chapters 5 through 10 sort of trace the development from this antagonism, how it progresses. But the main emphasis of this section is what Jesus revealed about himself through his actions and through his words, but we see in the process this movement from reservation to open hostility. And what this does is it makes more obvious to distinguish unbelief from belief. And that's the key emphasis that John is communicating in this book. The third sign took place in an unexpected setting. Sometime later, Jesus returned to Jerusalem from having been in the northern area, went back south, and he went there to celebrate one of the Jewish feasts, and he was going to use that occasion to minister to people. But John does not specify here which feast it was. Elsewhere in the Gospels, he usually identifies the feast, but he usually did so because the events and the teachings had some association with it. But in this case, he didn't. They didn't have a relevance, and so the identity of the feast was not important. But when you don't identify something, it puts pressure on scholars to try to figure out which feast was it. And so you might have been thinking that. I wonder which feast it was of all the possibilities. So as you might imagine, there are those who are trying to figure out which one it was. Some scholars favor the three pilgrim feasts that the Mosaic Law required Jewish males to attend. That would be Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. One of the professors at Dallas Seminary preferred the last of these. That was Harold Honer, for those of you who might know who that is. He conceded that the identity is probably impossible to know for sure. But then there's Jewish scholar Alfred Edersheim, who believed that it was the Feast of Purim. But I don't know that we need to know. If we needed to know, John would have told us. I'm going to leave it as we don't really know for sure. But I think it was just he noted that there was a feast that was celebrated, and that's what brought Jesus to Jerusalem. Then there's the pool area that is mentioned, and that is identifiable today. As a matter of fact, on one of the occasions I was able to go to Israel, I was able to see that that the place where the pool is. It's not a pool now. It's just an empty place that's in shambles to some degree. And I think I'll have a picture of it coming up here in just a little bit. But the Sheep Gate was understood to be in the northern part of Jerusalem's wall, just west of the northeast corner. And there are various Greek manuscripts that refer to this pool, and it has been referred to as in the spelling differences here in different manuscripts. Bethesda, Bethsaida, Bethzatha, and Belzetha. So which one is it? We think that Bethesda is the correct one. I think it has the best evidence, and you can check it out if you like. It means house of outpouring, or perhaps a house of mercy, maybe outpouring of mercy. The modern name is the St. Anne's Pool, and that is because there's a church that's right next to it now called the Church of St. Anne, which I recall has wonderful acoustics. Different ones, when we went in it, would sing, and it just reverberated around in there. So that's what kind of sticks out in my mind. But evidently there were two pools that were covered by a colonnade or a portico on all four sides of the complex, and then a fifth colonnade that separated the two pools. And the various porches then would provide some protection from the elements, and the pool had some other points of interest that would draw people to it, as we will see. So looking at verses 3 through 4, in these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the waters. For an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. And you might think, where'd that come from? Well, hold that thought. This pool became a haven for people with physical needs. This pool area was a popular place for the ill to gather because there was some element of hope associated with it. And the number of people here are identified as a great multitude. And I don't know why, for some reason, Coronado Park comes to mind. That's been in the news recently. A place for misfortunate people to gather. And this included several different specific designations of sick, blind, lame, and paralyzed. And the gathering of the people was not simply because they were all in great need and could identify with one another, but there was a tradition in this place that gave some element of hope that maybe healing could happen. This section of the text has been questioned on its authenticity as far as the readings in the various Greek manuscripts. It's been indicated that no Greek manuscript before AD 400 contains these words, that is the last phrase of verse 3 and all of verse 4. So it's found just in the earlier manuscripts. So there's a little bit of manuscript theory that's behind the consideration of this. So it's assumed that scribes at some point added these statements in order to clarify the reference later about the stirring of the waters or the troubling of the waters, so that somebody had some idea of where that came from, indicating there must have been some tradition that was passed along. So it's been suggested that these were scribal explanations based on superstition. Of course, superstitions were common then. Of course, we don't have any today. Or do we? It's interesting how often superstitions still plague us. If you did something a certain way and it had positive results, how inclined are you to try to do something that certain way again? I think even Michael Jordan wore the same shorts because they worked for him before. I guess will work for me playing professionally. So anyway, that's a different issue. Some suggest that a more probable explanation for the troubling of the waters was the presence of springs that occasionally gushed waters into the pools below the surface of the water. And they suggest, well, maybe it was warm water and it had some mineral content and had some medicinal benefit for people who are suffering from muscle or joint ailments. And so some experienced that, and therefore this superstition came about. It's also possible that John simply recorded what was the prevailing view of the day to explain why everybody was there. And that certainly is possible. It's actually possible that an angel could have stirred the water. We don't know that, but might have been, might have happened at some point, and that's what people remembered, because it is possible. So it's not really totally surprising. But some unusual event of the past must have triggered some initial healing situation, and so there got this tradition going, and people needed some hope and kept it alive. And John simply indicated what the perception of the time was to explain the situation. So nonetheless, this text has been questioned as to its authenticity. I did some analysis of it myself and have not come away with a definitive answer one way or another, because I have a propensity to put some weight on the majority text view as opposed to simply the critical text view. But we'll save that for another time when we get to another section of John that's going to require a little more consideration. So, moving on to the next section then, the personal challenge of infirmity and inability. Verses 5 and 6. Now a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he already had been in that condition for a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" That seems like a superfluous question. Who would not want to be made well? But we need to think about that. So here we see the burden of a long-lasting disability. And if you've had any particular ailment that has bothered you for any significant amount of time, you can relate to the unpleasantness of such an experience. A man was identified with a serious protracted disability. The man's sickness may have been paralysis. That was the last of the items that was listed that would fit the situation that was there. Some have concluded that it may have been as a result of some sin in his past, looking at verse 14, which we'll get to. Perhaps he had even some arthritic condition that complicated the ailment. Again, a lot of speculation going into some of these things. We can only go for sure by what the text actually says. John's reference to the length of his illness seems to be just to document its seriousness and the man's hopeless condition. But commentators have had to speculate. At least some have suggested there's maybe some symbolic significance to the 38 years. For example, that was the length of time in a more specific sense of Israel's wandering in the wilderness. And you can kind of make a little bit of mental parallel there. Going back to the rebellion at Kadesh Barnea before they were to enter the promised land, it seems more natural to take it as simply, it was 38 years, okay? And so you have to be careful when you read commentators because they will speculate often trying to figure things out. And that's okay to try to figure things out, just realize when it's speculation. So the issue is his needy condition and Jesus' response to it. That's what's being pointed out. But 38 years is a long time to deal with some kind of condition such as this. Jesus indicated knowledge of and concern for the man. That's what's also pointed out here. How did Jesus know about him? Well, it could be someone had communicated that to him. He may have even said it. We don't have those details. Or John may have communicated this to impress his readers with Jesus' supernatural knowledge of how long this man had this condition. In Capernaum, Jesus had healed another paralytic that was lowered through the roof, that you may recall, where they took the roof material out of the way and lowered the sick man down to Jesus, who was in this house in Capernaum. That was Mark 2:1-12, but this is at Bethesda, different time, different location, but another situation of a similar nature. In that case, Jesus told the man, your sins are forgiven. So, again, there's that reference to sin. Jesus' question here may have probed the man to discover if he had a desire for healing and if he was willing to put himself in Jesus' hands. Some people are actually content to remain in their miserable condition because it gives them something to talk about. Nah, that doesn't really happen. But John 3:19-20 talks about people living in darkness and loving the darkness, so that's not a surprise. Jesus apparently only delivered people who wanted his help. And so it was a legitimate question, but it may have led the man to think about his helpless condition. And what's interesting is that this may have been the only person that Jesus healed that day. And he was in a place where there were lots of people. He could have just said, okay, everybody's well, pack up and go. But we only have reference to this one. Isn't that interesting? Because it was a teaching opportunity. And today, not everybody's healed when we pray and ask for healing. Why is that? Because God does what he does. So, and Jesus saves people who want salvation. He doesn't save everybody indiscriminately, except that you put your faith and trust in Christ. And it's interesting also that there seems to be no ground in this person himself as to why Jesus singled him out for this special favor. Why did he select him? He wasn't particularly expressive. He wasn't particularly helpful. The only explanation is that Jesus sought to reveal something about himself through this man's healing. Interesting to think about. The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I am coming, another steps down before me." So the man is focused on, he's at this pool. There's this tradition that when the water is stirred, if you get in there first, then you're going to be healed. And he doesn't have the physical wherewithal to get himself into the pool before somebody else gets in before him. So that's a problem. So there's an expression of anguish and frustration. The man seemed quite aware of his desperate situation. He couldn't do anything about it, and he wanted to, apparently. Obviously, this lame individual believed that only the first person into the water was going to experience the healing. And, you know, because that was the popular tradition or superstition at the time. And so the man was focused on, I need somebody to toss me in the pool at the right time. Well, maybe toss is a little strong, but to get into the pool, he didn't have the physical wherewithal. So he was focused on that. He wasn't thinking about anything regarding who Jesus was. It's just, hey, are you here to help me get in the pool when it's stirred up at the right time, under the right conditions, whatever that is? But he did seem to recognize that he was in a serious state of affairs and that he was not in a condition to be able to fix it. And so he was reminded of his need. And the person who could fix what he was in need of was right there, but he didn't know it yet at that time. And the man seemed quite aware of his need for help and thought Jesus might be able to help him, but not in the way he was thinking at the time. And so that was an interesting thing to for him to have to think through. So his statement shows that he had more faith in the superstition than he did in Jesus, because he didn't know who he was dealing with, apparently, at this point. But he did sense that there was something that he needed to do to be healed, and that would be to get into the pool. So in this case, there was nothing that he needed to do to be healed, other than perhaps to desire it, because that's what Jesus had asked. One commentator wrote, "We must feel that while faith was commonly the prerequisite of healing, it was not absolutely necessary. Jesus is not limited by human frailty as he works the works of God." This seems to be an instance where Jesus healed a man without any obvious response or expression of faith. Now, one of the things that I find to be very interesting about how Jesus healed people, and we have many different records, and I've pointed this out before, and I just think it's interesting, he didn't ever do it the same way. There was no magic formula. That's, I think, instructive for us. Because we want a magic formula. We want to just know, give me the rules. Tell me the formula. Abracadabra kazam, you know, whatever words I need, let's just make it happen. If I could just get the formula. But that's not how it worked. It does it differently. And in this case, it wasn't that the man just had such strong faith. He didn't have any. I mean, he had faith that if he got tossed in the pool, he would be fine. So, go figure. So, that's what we want to keep in mind as we think about this. So let's move on then to the presentation of active healing and open resistance. Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up your bed and walk." And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed and walked, and that day was the Sabbath. Very interesting little addition there. So this was an actively initiated healing apart from solicitation. This man didn't follow Jesus around, didn't go seeking for him, didn't send somebody to go after him. Jesus took the initiative to heal this man. He asked the man if he wanted to be healed. The lame man didn't even initiate the conversation. He was probably not expecting to be healed that day, because you never knew when the water was going to be stirred, but you're still that hope. And Jesus simply used his words to heal the man. I mean, he created the universe. I mean, so a little healing can't be that big of a deal in comparison. But his words also instructed the man, told him, take up your bed. Obviously, Jesus had also given him enough strength as well as the health to be able to carry his mat, the thing that he was sleeping on. And the invalid in this case was healed immediately. Now, that's not normal. I mean, if you've been laying around, not able to use your legs, let's say, for 38 years, I mean, you got to go through physical therapy. Everybody knows that. But Jesus didn't say, okay, here's a card, go check out this place and get some physical therapy, and then you're going to be able to walk. And it was immediate. So it came with all of that. I mean, you know, his legs would surely have been in atrophy. The muscles would have been just kind of on vacation. And so he had full use of his muscles. He was able to get up and I can't imagine the sensation that he would have had in his thinking and in his physical being of being able to walk when he hadn't been able to walk for 38 years. That is phenomenal. Now, the prophets had predicted that when Messiah came, he would heal the lame, Isaiah 35:1-7. And this was proof for all Israel, or for all of Jerusalem, to see that the Messiah had appeared, because he healed this man who had been, you know, dealing with this physical inability, this disability, for 38 years. And interestingly, by carrying his pallet on the Sabbath, the man triggered a controversy. He was healed. Like, that's a bad thing. And that was never the topic of the conversation from the naysayers. It wasn't, you know, how did you do that? It was, why did you do it on the Sabbath? Of all things, what were you thinking? I mean, that's just hard to imagine. So, when Jesus commanded the man to pick up his bed and walk, it basically made Jesus responsible for the situation that followed. And he deliberately caused the situation. Didn't Jesus know it was the Sabbath? Didn't he know what the rules were? You don't tell somebody to carry their bed. So it probably explains why Jesus healed this particular man at this time and in this place, because there was a lesson to communicate. Then looking at verses 10 through 13, the Jews therefore said to him who was cured, it is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed. He answered them, he who made me well said to me, take up your bed and walk. Then they asked him, who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk? But the one who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, a multitude being in that place. He lost track of them. The timing of this event created open hostility. And Jesus used this healing as an opportunity for instruction. More than once, Jesus would use the Sabbath as an opportunity to communicate something about himself that would hopefully cause the Jews to consider who he was, that he had authority to do so, that superseded any authority that they had in their making of their rules that they did. And he wanted them to realize that he had the right to work on the Sabbath just as his Father, his Heavenly Father, did. And so this was the first open hostility that Jesus would encounter that John records here. According to the prevailing Jewish interpretation of the law, it was not legitimate to carry anything from one place to another on the Sabbath. Doing so constituted a capital offense that could result in stoning. That sounds like a capital offense, doesn't it? Carrying a mat. Now, it needs to be pointed out that the rabbis did allow for some exceptional cases, such as moving a lame person for compassionate reasons. Well, you would think this would have been one of those, but if it wasn't specifically spelled out, then maybe they didn't accept that. So these Jews indicated that it was not lawful. But whose law were they talking about? God's law regarding the Sabbath, or the laws that they had put in place? God's intent for the fourth commandment was to free people from having to work to earn a living for one day out of seven because they needed it. And this paralytic was not breaking the intent of the law, but he was only violating the rabbinic interpretation of it because they had this tendency to create humanly contrived safety fences around the law just to make sure that we couldn't possibly mess up the law, but they missed what the intent was in the process. So Jesus indicates the failure of man to grasp God's intention in his law to be good for man. It's supposed to be beneficial, not harmful. And Jesus was pointing out that he had authority over the religious leaders of Israel. He is, in fact, the Son of God, the Messiah. He was not under their man-made rules. Rather, it was the other way around. The healed man indicated that he was only following instructions. So he, whether intentionally or not, effectively passed off responsibility for his disobeying the rabbi's rules by blaming Jesus. His concern was not to express gratitude for what Jesus had done for him, but essentially to excuse his own actions so that he didn't get in trouble with the authorities. And he may have feared for his life. So we can understand that would be a concern. The Jewish leaders wanted to know who dared to contradict the accepted meaning of the fourth commandment. In their eyes, Jesus was a worse offender than the man who carried his pallet because he told him to do it, and he healed him on the Sabbath. What they should have recognized is that Jesus was the Messiah, just as had been predicted, because he healed a lame man as he did. They should have recognized that. They should have known, but they were not prepared to accept that. They were a little too focused on their own turf, their own rules, their own expectations for others around them. Verses 14 and 15. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you have been made well. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you." The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. The healing resulted in opportunity for future responses. Jesus sought out the man for further instruction, perhaps to give the man opportunity to be maybe a little more responsive. So Jesus found him in the temple, may have been looking for him, warned him not to use his healing as an opportunity to participate in sin. Now that you have been made well, what are you going to do with the time you have left? Beware of worse consequences than this former ailment could have been referencing eternal damnation. Worse things that would happen if you don't respond, if you don't recognize who he is, that would certainly be worse. Jesus may have been giving him an opportunity to respond at that point, that there's no evidence that he did. And perhaps not everyone who experiences some form of healing also experiences the regeneration, that is the real healing that we need. And there may be something to grasp in that regard as well. Jesus' point was that the man should regard his new health as an opportunity to make a new break from sin rather than to live in it. Galatians 5:13 says, "For you, brethren, have been called to liberty, only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another." Because we know sickness is not always the direct result of personal sin. Because Jesus is going to deal with that more specifically in John chapter 9, verses 1 through 4, where we read, John chapter 9, verse 3, Jesus answered, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him," because the disciples had asked, "Well, who sinned? Was it this man or his parents? You've got to blame somebody here." And Jesus said, "Neither. This is an opportunity for you to see God at work." We sometimes suffer direct consequences of our own sin. We are well aware of that, or should be. But rarely is it a retributive thing that God does. The emphasis of Job is that very specifically. Because we know that there are lifestyle choices that have very real effects that we see around us. There are a lot of choices that people make that result in very bad consequences. The healed man responded by identifying his healer. It seems that the man's motives for telling the authorities about Jesus was not to glorify him. Maybe he was looking for an out, taking the pressure off of himself. I think that's what he was attempting to do. And he may not have come to realize, or at least may not have come to accept, that Jesus was who he was indicating that he was. And so it seems almost as if this man was maybe a little ungrateful and focused on just saving his own skin in the presence of the Jewish leaders there. And he probably didn't appreciate Jesus' warning either. It may have been evidence that he didn't just have a hard head and understanding, but maybe a hard heart as well. He may represent those whom even the signs cannot lead to authentic faith, because he saw a great miracle. He experienced a great miracle, but he didn't seem to recognize the significance of that in the broadest, most significant, important sense, that this was indicating that this was the Messiah in his presence and he needed to trust in him. So this passage shows a man directly experiencing God's grace and neglecting to respond appropriately, failing to believe in him. It also provides an opportunity for Jesus to show himself to the Jews as their Messiah. And that's going to come out in the discussions that are going to flow from this. And so we need to ask ourselves, do we recognize who Jesus is? Do we see him for who he is? Do we simply accept the provision that he has for us without the reality of who are you dealing with? Who are you really recognizing? And do we do so with an open heart? That is a good question for us to consider.